Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled The Future of Deposit Insurance and Opposing Costs. Our moderator today is Brian Schneider. Brian is a partner at Minnat, Phelps, and Phillips. He is a member of the firm's industry leading consumer financial services practice, where he focuses on advising clients through the gamut of consumer financial services regulatory and enforcement matters, particularly as it relates to supervision, enforcement, and fair lending. Prior to joining the firm, Brian served as associate director for the Division of Supervision, Enforcement, and Fair Lending at the CFPB. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federal Society. With that, Brian, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this webinar that will explore the existing framework for deposit insurance and whether it should be preserved or perhaps in some ways reformed. We will reserve some time, as mentioned, for questions at the end, but I'd encourage folks to put their questions into the Q&A box as we're going along. I'll be monitoring that, and we'll be glad to spring your questions on our panelists as they come in to keep the discussion going as real time and lively as possible. A bank's stability depends in significant part on its ability to attract and retain deposits. However, because of the inherently illiquid nature of the business banking model, coupled with the asymmetrical availability of information between bank managers and depositors, banks must work to obtain and keep depositors' trust. History has shown that human psychology many times makes this a difficult thing to do. Deposit insurance, at least in theory, assists banks in maintaining the public's confidence and thereby keeping retail funding stable. In addition, the status of being a federally insured depository institution confers benefits, such as the ability to obtain a Federal Reserve Master account, that are not always available to many other institutions, even those that appear to be similarly situated and likely pose the same or even less risk to the financial infrastructure. I suspect that to many Americans, deposit insurance is understood to be a phenomenon of the federal government exclusively. But the feds are actually a little bit late to the game. Indeed, state-based and private deposit insurance regimes existed as long ago as the early 19th century, well before the creation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in 1933. Since then, the FDIC has largely displaced all other primary deposit insurance in the United States, although private primary deposit insurance is still available for state-chartered credit unions in some states, and excess deposit insurance is available through various state-based and private enterprises. With the new administration and Congress poised to reconsider a host of financial services regulations, the time seems apt to look in depth at the deposit insurance requirement, as well as the near federal monopoly in the primary deposit insurance market. So now I'm pleased to introduce our interlocutors for today's discussion. Meg Tyer is a partner at the law firm of Davis Polk and the head of their financial institutions practice and a member of their fintech team. Meg provides strategic bank and financial regulatory advice to many of the world's largest financial institutions, in addition to regional banks, fintechs, cryptocurrency exchanges, and other digital asset companies. Also joining us is Dennis Adams. Dennis recently retired after 31 years as the president and CEO of American Mutual Share Insurance Corporation, ASI, which operates as a primary insurer in 10 states, is the nation's only non-federal primary deposit insurer for state-chartered credit unions. through a subsidiary. ASI also provides excess share insurance to federally and state chartered credit unions in 33 states. Dennis is currently consulting to financial institutions through Dennis R. Adams Consulting. So Meg, if we could turn to you first, could you provide a bit of an historical framework for the deposit insurance regime that we are experiencing today?
Sure. Thank you very much, Brian. I think I'll start by asserting that deposit insurance is a necessary component of a developed economy. The International Association of Deposit Insurers says there are about 113 countries around the world that have it, virtually all of the developed economies. It's a social choice that we've made in this country, along with other developed economies. It's not costless. It's a trade-off like all social policies, in the sense that the decision has been made that the cost of bank runs to the economy and the banking sector and to individuals is too high. Therefore, an insurance system is needed. Our federal insurance system started in 1933. Before that, we did have some state-level insurance systems in a number of states. They largely failed because they were opt-in, so that the weakest banks opted into the state insurance systems. There have been from time to time, and there are in some other countries as well, private insurance systems. I'll leave that to Dennis. The key question on deposit insurance is, who pays for it? And the answer is that directly the banking sector itself pays for it. The banking sector pays insurance premiums into the deposit insurance fund. The deposit insurance fund then pays up to the deposit insurance limit when a bank fails. Obviously, those costs are passed on to bank customers in some way, either fully or in part. And then in our system, there is an indirect backstop from the taxpayer, although it really happens through collateralized lending from the FDIC. That through the FDIC, the taxpayer has not paid. Now, I'm going to leave aside the special programs in the financial crisis, and we can come back to them. But our deposit insurance fund has managed to pay out depositors. And if we look at the March 2023 turmoil, there where the systemic risk exception was invoked, there's a specific statute that requires that there be a special fee assessment on the banks. So the way that I look at it is the banks pay directly. Some of the costs are going to be passed on to consumers. And there is a taxpayer backstop, which is thankfully rarely needed. So that's a little bit of the framework on how deposit insurance at the federal level works in this country. I think most folks know it goes up to 250, 500 if you have a joint account. There are a number of proposals for reform that are currently being suggested, which I'll go over quite quickly. And these proposals have come out after the March 23 turmoil, and there's an excellent FDIC report that discusses all of the possibilities that are on the table, doesn't take a position. The position that I would take is that the 250 ought to be indexed for something, for inflation, et cetera, et cetera. Putting 250 in the law and then waiting for Congress to have to act every time that changes doesn't make sense to me. So that is reform number one that I would propose. Reform number two, which has been in the air since the 2023 turmoil, is to have a higher amount. I don't know what it is. It has to be data driven. 2 million, 5 million, 10 million on what I'm going to loosely call operational deposits. These are basically the what you would call, and it's not when it's not in its fancy Sunday go to meet and clothes, what you would call your basic checking account, but not for consumers, not for flesh and blood humans, but the payroll processing of a small and medium sized enterprise, you know, the accounts of religious organizations, churches, temples, synagogues, mosques, often go above 250, 501c3s. And it makes a lot of sense, I think, to have a special regime for those accounts of those kinds of entities, because that's where we saw the major problems in 2023. We'd have to work out how it was paid for and who paid for it. But I will note that there's a proposal out there, there are multiple bills out there on it, one by J.D. Vance, one by Maxine Waters. So we're looking at something where you have very unusual configuration of folks who are thinking about this thoughtfully. And in the Q&A, we can come back to how you might actually make that work. And then I'll close by noting that we did have this temporary program during the financial crisis that worked pretty well, that for a limited period of time permitted the FDIC to push a button and during a moment of crisis have unlimited deposit insurance and then unpush the button and have it go away. I'm not for unlimited deposit insurance for a number of reasons. Maybe the FDIC kept that on too long, but Congress in its wisdom took that power away from the FDIC with the Dodd-Frank Act. It brought it back silently for a limited period of time during COVID where it was never used. But this idea that you have a special button that you can push in stressed times with special fees is, I think, an interesting idea not to forget about. And let me just close there and turn it over to Dennis.
Yeah, Dennis, if you could maybe share a comparable history from your perspective of the private insurance market that you are familiar with.
Thank you, Brian. And Meg, thank you very much for the information. That was very valuable. And I was kind of giggling, thinking about all the law changes that went through during my tenure and all the things that changed. And I can remember when they had the deposit insurance index based on inflation, and the first year or two after they didn't adjust it. I said, why aren't they adjusting it? Because we were in a situation where we benchmarked ours off of the federal. Quick background, if I may. I'm a CPA, CFP, and with an MBA in finance. And over the years, I had the opportunity to teach adjunct for about 17 years to graduate students. So I've talked a lot about finance, from investing to banking, et cetera. And in 2022, I retired from American Share Insurance after 31 years as CEO and four before that as a senior VP of risk management. And I'd like to make it very clear that none of my positions today reflect that of ASI. Currently, I'm not employed by ASI, nor do I consult with ASI. So please let you know this is based on just my background, my experience of running the company through many, many different cycles. And those cycles were numerous from the S&L crisis when I first joined the company and developing risk management systems to make sure our program, American Share Insurance, didn't face calamities or charges that would make it insolvent or unable to function. The FISLIC collapse of the late 80s in Rhode Island, there was a private insurance program in 1990. The year I became CEO, I was told it was failing, ended up costing the state. So some of the things Meg talked about are very, very, very documented. The development of FIDICIA, which brought in regulation at the federal level over our state programs such as ASI. Y2K, you're going to have cash at the door, aren't you? The Great Recession, oh my gosh, how come my house is worth half of what it was before? And all the issues that related to that. And then subsequently, living on a fixed income portfolio, as does NCUA, our counterpart, and much of the FDIC, I'm sure, when you deal with Treasury and government bonds, the fixed income yields from 2011 to 2022 were devastating. So it made earnings situations very complicated, and also forced what we called special assessment premiums. And I think FDIC, NCUA, we all lived through that. And the institutions that we insured funded and paid those additional incremental costs. In my time, I spent a lot of time talking to international credit union movement. I am not in the banking industry, but the credit union industry, or was, and actually worked in developing a program in Guatemala that they implemented. And 10 years later, I was called back to figure out why it wasn't working, which was a lot of fun as well. But personally, I worked with many of the private insurers that did exist. And as a little background of that, private insurance, as Brian and Meg have inferred, existed before the Civil War, after the Civil War, up to the Great Depression. And ironically, one of the few funds that did very well was Ohio. So I'm proud of that. But it went away in the teens of of the 1900s. And in the Great Depression, the byproduct was FDIC, federal insurance, to comfort the runs, minimize the runs on banking, because it was a definite crisis to deal with and the government dealt with it. What I would like to emphasize is private deposit insurance for credit unions or federal deposit insurance for credit unions never even took place until 1971 at the federal level, with the introduction of the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund as administered by the National Credit Union Administration. I would like to highlight, though, in 1957, in the state that Brian hails from, was the first private deposit insurance program for credit unions or at federal or state level, but it was a state program. And it didn't last a lot of years, but it did function. And in Massachusetts, joined in 1961 and continued to survive through even the worst of times in the early 2000s before it reverted to just excess deposit insurance. NCUSIS came into play in 71. And between 1970 and 2000, there were numerous private funds, at one time as many as 21 private funds for credit unions, but it basically narrowed down to about 10 of which I interacted with over the years in different means and ways, trying to make it unified. They had a pretty good foothold on the state chartered aspect of credit unions, because private programs could only insure state chartered credit unions, not federally regulated credit unions. Those were strictly NCOA's responsibility and priority. Today, ASI is the sole provider. In the late 80s through as late as early 2000s, I observed many of those programs go out of business as state regulators changed their mind about having the option, or the program thought it was better for their members to be federally insured, or the impulse was everybody wants to be federally insured. Our members didn't do that to us, but it happened in a number of the private programs, and by the early 2000s, ASI was the sole provider, currently operating in 10 states across the country from west to east, rather dispersed, but not all 50 states. In 1981, we created the idea, after the $100,000 kicked in on the deposit insurance level, to insure excess deposits above $100,000, later on above the $250,000, as provided by the federal program. In 1993, our company was involved in creating Excess Share Insurance Corporation, which is now a licensed provider of excess and share insurance in 33 states across the nation, as regulated by each individual state insurance agency, and it covers federally chartered as well as state chartered credit unions. So we are out there, the ESI program is out there helping state and federally chartered institutions provide above the $250,000 that is fundamental insurance. And I'm not going to go into all the details about trust, joint accounts. If you allow me that benefit, I'd appreciate it. But, you know, we do know, and I do acknowledge, there are different means for expanding your coverage on the federal level. The thing I'd like to point out, since the dialogue is about options, I thought maybe it'd be wise to give you some of the benefits I saw attributable to private and some of the detriments. You know, clearly nothing is perfect. And as we all know, as Meg prefaced, that there were failures, no question about it. ASI was not one of them, and I'm proud of that fact, but, you know, it is an issue. First of all, we're a business partner to these credits that we insure. We're not a regulator. We're an insurer. So like many mutual insurance companies, our mutual owners own the program. They elect the board. That board operates for the best interest of the insurance fund under the regulatory structure that is forced to work under, and that varies from state to state, not counting the home state of Ohio for ASI and ESI. The coverage is broader, built into the contract and the statute of the governing statute in Ohio. The $250 is per individual account of a member. So if a member of a credit union just had four savings account, keeping it simple again, ASI would be responsible for four times $250. Under the pure definition under federal, the savings account of one class would be up to $250 only. That gave the broader coverage to these individual credit unions. Over the years, and I can't speak for current years because I'm not running the company, nor am I engaged with them, but in the years and up to where I left, the equity ratio was superior to that of the NCUSIF, but I always felt we had to be superior because we were private and we didn't have the full faith and credit backing of the federal government. So your on-book equity is a very critical variable to all the state regulators that approved of the 10 states of ASI's operation. We also had very creative and flexible risk management processes that I instituted when I first started that were matured by other leaders in that capacity over the years under my supervision, and did a great job of creating solutions that were timely. like I've told everybody, I said, I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, but I guarantee you haven't seen it before. Good luck. And you better be creative and innovative or you might not survive it. During the Great Recession, we created solutions and secondary capital solutions that proved very valuable that NCUA later used in solutions they had in the state of Texas and elsewhere across the country, where these institutions paid back the insurance fund and are still operating today because of those creative, innovative risk management solutions. We were subject to and had broad, diverse regulatory oversight. We're not an independent agency of the federal government or an agency of any state government, and we're subject to state banking and insurance regulations in various states across the country. Under federal law, FDICIA, the Regal Community Development Act, CFPB, which I'll let Brian explain to me where that is today, but anyhow, CFPB has authority over the program as well. And we have a lot of requirements to provide regulatory annual regulatory exam to all these states in which we're approved, and that makes our safety, I think, somewhat assured on a very diverse solution. The NCUA does not have 50 states coming in and looking at their program, and I know that they have federal oversight and involvement, but I'm saying on a state level, that was unique. On the dark side, the challenges, how do you compete against the full faith and credit of the federal government? As we noted regarding insurance above and beyond the insurance limit, we contractually can't do that. We never were asked to do it. We didn't do it when we had situations of uninsured deposits. Those individuals absorbed those losses. There were not many cases like that, but it did occur. The economies of scale are a problem. Size is always an issue when you're running a business, and certainly being in 10 states versus 50 is not only an economy of scale issue. And when you're 2-4% of the industry, you're a very, very, very small player, much like Quidians are only 6-7% of the banking industry. So everybody has their fit and where we fit. And by the way, the credit system is doing well today, and even though the banks are significantly dominant over the credit in the way of size. Concentration risk, when you're only in 10 states, as you know, if there's a problem in Nevada, there's a problem with the institutions. So anyhow, moving on, I'll finish up. The burden of catastrophic losses resides with the mutual members, not the federal government or state government. And regulations governing private insurance and NCUA's interface with ASI always made it difficult to get new customers or members. And that always raised concerns, which we had to compete and challenge in regulatory or legislative environments. So in summary, I'll wrap up by just saying the private program can exist. It can function, but it needs proper financial structure, regulatory oversight, and leadership to survive under changing times. Under good times, it's very easy to do a lot of things. Under bad times, it's much more taxing. And I'll close with that, Brian. I hope I didn't take too long, but thank you for the opportunity.
No, well, thank you both for the, I'm sorry, Meg.
Yeah, I accidentally deleted a fascinating question that came in through the chat.
No, we still got it. We still got it. No, you haven't done anything. We'll get to those questions. I just, you know, in fact, here's the lead up to one of them, at least, is, you know, we've chatted, and if you walked down the street and could get the attention of fellow travelers walking with you and ask them if they thought deposit insurance is a good thing or a bad thing. I've never done this study, but I think other people have. I think universally everyone would say it's a good thing. Sure, who doesn't like it? And it sort of seems like it's free, because you just put your money in an insured institution and you've got insurance. But of course, there is a cost to it. Meg and Dennis, you've both alluded to that. One of the questions that came in then is, how would we measure? What's a way to measure the true cost of deposit insurance that is passed on to the consumer? And the follow-up was, would we simply compare the interest rate on FDIC insured deposits to wholesale deposit accounts right above the FDIC limit? So is there any thoughts you have from your experiences about how to think about the true cost? Dennis, is it more transparent in your case? I don't know. Meg, you want to take that first?
No, we don't know. I don't think we know. You know, there's a lot of interesting studies out there about the Durbin interchange, and the idea was that the savings would be passed on to consumers. They weren't. We've seen a lot of studies. I don't think the differential in interest rates is the right way to do it. But my assumption is, and this is more cognitive bias than actual knowledge, that a portion of the cost is passed on to the consumer, but not the full cost. It would be really good to get some empirical data on this.
Brian, if I could add, we spent a lot of time analyzing what you would call the direct business cost. I agree with Meg. Figuring out how it affected the consumer is another question. But on the direct business cost, during the 5 years of difficult recovery from the Great Recession, American General Insurance had to charge special premium assessments of 61.5 basis points based on depository base. So that was a lot of money. Millions of dollars were spent. NCUA charged about 83.3 basis points during those 5 years. Later on, they gave back rebates a number of years in the future. So the net cost, generally speaking, between the two programs was in that 50 to 60 basis points of what you would call supplemental cost. Second of all, the cost to creditors is different from FDIC because creditors put a deposit with their insurance program from which the insurance program earns a living off of and makes money off of. So we get up to when I retired, a 1.3% deposit. So on a $100 million share-based institution, that's $1.3 million deposit. We invest that money, make money on it to pay our overhead, claims, insurance losses, et cetera. And NCUA charges 1.0% on that same $100 million or $1 million deposit. So the money we made on the deposit was our source of income. Quickly, when I made that comment about the yield compression during 09 through about 21, 22, that compression drove the cost of, they drove down the earnings of both NCUA and ASI, which is why we charge supplemental premiums in those difficult times. So the direct cost can be tangibly evaluated and calculated. And then I'm assuming the creditors would have passed that through a reduced rate paid on deposits. That's my only comment. I don't have any analytics to support the impact on consumers, but general business practice would indicate if the cost of operating my business is up, the opportunity to give that back to the consumer has got to be reduced.
Is there any reason, just to probe a little further there, there were more competitors, generally prices fall, is that whatever the cost is of deposit insurance, would the entry of additional market participants, would there be any reason to believe that that would be driving that cost down? And is there any risk or concern to that, Meg?
I think, my point of view is it's great that the credit unions have this private insurance, but it's a very small percentage. Dennis, I think it's 3% of all credit unions. So if there could be a viable, really workable private deposit insurance, somebody clever would have created it. And what we see is small minor auxiliary programs. And I think, this does go to the point about, a couple of things in the questions. Does 2023 tell us that we're going to have more deposit runs by corporate treasurers because they can do it this way? Yes. The lesson from 2023 is we are at more risk of deposit runs now than we ever have been. And the recent Stephen Kelly paper is really great. Don't think that it was just networked depositors in Silicon Valley that are techies. I just think that all small and medium-sized enterprises, 501c3s, religious entities, if they're not at a super large bank, they're really concerned. And if we want in this country to have a banking sector where we have mid-sized and regional banks for a large, complex economy, we're going to have to do some kind of deposit insurance reform. And we are in a period of increased danger since 2023.
A comment on that, if I may. Meg, you're absolutely right regarding the presence, the factor, the portion of the industry, and also the very fact that credit are a small portion of the whole banking industry. However, prior to the challenges... Oh,
and sorry, Dennis, just to make this point, and your insurance program is an even smaller, tiny percentage of the credit union sector.
That's correct. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not here to disagree. What I'd like to point out, though, is this. Prior to the calamities that drove a lot of challenges from 85 on, early 80s on, there were a number of programs representing about 25% of the credit unions were privately insured. And now we're down to the small percentage you've indicated that ASI maintains. And I do believe that if we had a network of every state, not just the maybe 25 or 30 states that had it at that time, when I was practicing or running the institution, there were a number of states that just weren't permissible. You can't have non-federal. Half of the states or more were saying that you can't have it. The other half said you could, but then half of them approved it. So getting through the state regulatory network is very challenging. So if it's individual states, like all other insurance companies are currently licensed by state, then that becomes a difficult challenge, but a possible challenge, as long as you have a good financial system structure. And we had a group of 10 programs that tried to put together, just so you know, a plan where they would guarantee and protect each other. That never got off the ground because of individual attitudes about, you're not coming into my state and you're not going to cross my line. It became a problem because we worked hard in the late 80s trying to put the 10 funds together, get reinsurance and other programs that would make it more viable. And it was very difficult. But if that could be revisited and there was enough demand for states' rights, it is a possible solution at a national level, but it's going to take state laws or a major federal law.
I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting idea to explore. I will note that what's happened in the meantime is where the private sector has gone is IntraFi, which, you know, that's used to be Promontory Network, and also the system of reciprocal deposits, and then your corporate treasurer can sweep into money market funds overnight. So in there are other private sector solutions to that for the issues of deposit insurance that have been developed since the 1980s and are being widely used. And as we look at deposit insurance and deposit insurance reform, we have to acknowledge the existence of those systems as well.
Yeah, and I think when I worked, I met with and worked with Promontory, they were an excess deposit insurance concept at the time, right? Correct? They're not a first dollar coverage.
I think what they do is they divide it into chunks of 250 or less. So they don't themselves provide FDIC coverage, right, but they create a platform so that if you have $10 million, you can put it into 250 chunks around multiple banks with an easy little click once you're on the platform.
They're kind of like a traffic cop moving the money around. You're correct. I apologize. It's been a few years since I worked with them.
And it is what it is. There's an interesting question which we discussed in our prep section.
If I could, Meg, real quick. We viewed them as a broker. They were brokering deposits.
Correct.
My apologies.
Moral hazard. So there's a question about, does deposit insurance create moral hazard? And I think I'll start here, Dennis, and I know you'll want to jump in. I think the answer is yes, but that's okay. In other words, all social policies have a social trade-off. If the moral hazard here is that your everyday depositor, whether a consumer or small or medium size, or even the treasurer of a Fortune 50, will not be monitoring the deposits in the bank. My point of view is we've got about 800 years of history that shows us that depositors are terrible monitors. They don't do it well. They can't do it well. It's different if you're thinking about moral hazard between bank management going into riskier behaviors because they think that they're insured. And I'm not sure that that agency problem exists, but we have to ask ourselves moral hazard by whom, with whom, and then is this a moral hazard that is appropriate with social trade-offs? And my point of view is that when it comes to deposit insurance, the social policy trade-off and the costs make this an appropriate moral hazard at the depositor level. Particularly in light of the vast history showing us depositors can't monitor.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you that I doubt that the consumer is monitoring. Some of the institutional organizations are monitoring closely every investment, let alone their deposits. But on the consumer side, that lack of knowledge is what's so critical about, I think, about the full faith and credit concept that gives them that comfort that this is protected even if the management team mismanages or this institution, my institution, fails to operate.
I would go beyond that, right? So look, your Fortune 50 or large company treasurer better be sweeping into money market funds or into treasuries every night. And he's got the platform and the digital tools to do that. Yeah. But what about, the church around the corner who has 30 employees? What about, a 501c3? What about the local, the local contractor who does a cleaning service? They're going to be above 350 as they go towards hitting payroll. I don't think that these small and medium-sized enterprises can be, they're more like a consumer, even though they're a business or some other kind of entity, than they are like a Fortune 50 treasurer.
No, I agree with you. And I understand where you're going with that based on what has occurred in the last couple of years or occurred a few years back. And we also looked at that too. And I want to take a little different perspective of, I may move off the consumer for a second. But as an insurance program, we looked down and said, hey, is this institution that we're insuring, are they operating sufficiently and effectively? And we looked at the moral hazard of trusting management with our insurance fund. You know, and I think that the feds, I'm not sure the federal program looked at it exactly that way, but we did.
But that's a fair way, yeah.
We just sat there and said, how can we trust Frank or Mary Jo to run this institution that's hundreds of millions or billions of dollars? And that's why I said earlier on, proper risk management and risk assessment is critical. You know, brokering a deposit is one thing, but getting in there and ensuring that it's going to be there to some individual or entity. And by the way, the other thing that I want to point out, as I was retiring and moving towards retirement, the drift in the credit space to more commercial activity was growing. And those commercial activities were not multi-billion dollar companies. They were small local businesses that could be real estate owners, it could be painting companies or service companies, and they have $400,000, $500,000, $2 million on deposit. They're entrusting that credit union, that financial institution we insured, to handle those funds properly. So we viewed moral hazard as the biggest risk facing deposit insurance, as well as the consumer.
And just, Dennis, to get the different moral hazard strains. So the moral hazard you're talking about there was you as this insurance, it's the management agency problem.
Right.
That's the moral hazard, opposed to, is there a moral hazard on the depositor to bank side?
Yeah. What are they going to say or do to cause us a major problem?
Right. Right.
The other thing too, that you need to think about when you deal with, and I saw this firsthand, is adverse selection. So,
yes.
For example, if an institution that ASI would insure say, hey, I don't want to be here anymore, they have the right for their members to vote, for the board to make a business decision. It's like property insurance or whatever it is, we're going to switch. On the federal program, the rules are much more strict. They require 20% of the membership vote, and then a simple majority approve that change. Every vote that we worked on was successful, but it takes a lot of work to get someone to go from the federal insurance to the private versus the private to the federal. That's an imbalance that causes, a major problem. But what always worried me in the private sector, what happens in a catastrophic event like the Great Recession, and we have a big loss at ASI, will all the other healthies leave the program, then only the sickly reside in the program? That's a major challenge to the insurance program. That's
what happened with the state, with the few state level programs in the run up to the banking crisis of 1933. And that is why ultimately the state level programs didn't work, because of the adverse selection problem.
Adverse selection is a major challenge. It would be the same as if creditors were given the right to go to FDIC under the new government administration. That could cause a problem on the NCUSIF fund, which is a federal fund, if credit unions went over to become banks. Example. Not that I'm suggesting they are, but there's an awful lot going on currently that leaves one to wonder where everything's going to end up.
But why would that be a problem to combine the credit union and the bank insurance funds?
Well,
FISLIC was combined.
Yeah, the adverse selection situation resolves itself, and are the final ones to leave the program healthy enough to go to the new program? That's really how we viewed adverse selection. It's a concept. In other words, if all the healthy ones went over to FDIC due to a federal law, would NCUA be sitting there trying to settle and close out X number of creditors that did not qualify under FDIC's underwriting?
Oh.
Doesn't mean that FDIC is going to underwrite everything NCUA shows them. I'm not saying they won't, but it doesn't mean necessarily they have to. Unless the law would say that. A law change would say that, Brian. You know. Just a thought.
Right. Is there, I'm sure this is not the formal sense of moral hazard, but does the presence of deposit insurance and the existence of deposit insurance, what effect does that have on regulators? I'm not sure, you know, many lessons to be drawn from 2023. Some have said it was not exactly financial services regulators' moment in the sun to really shine and show that they were doing what they should be doing. And then in step the deposit insurance to make all the problems go away, so to speak, or at least seemingly go away. Is there, any thoughts on that? Is it, does it displace, does it displace the need for any other regulation? I don't know. It's just a thought that I had in terms of kind of, Meg, on, what are some of the lessons to take from 2023, which is our most recent real experience with a potential deposit insurance crisis?
Sure. Bank examination, which we call supervision or visitorial powers, has really existed for a couple of centuries. And its original thesis behind it was the need to prevent deposit runs. When we moved to federal deposit insurance in 1933, then the reason, I think it's a key policy reason behind supervision, is the protection of the deposit insurance fund, the taxpayer backstop. So having supervisor staff focused on major financial risks, underwriting standards, credit risk, interest rate risk, market risk, makes a lot of sense for the protection of the deposit insurance fund. We call that safety and soundness when it's writ large. So I am not certain that you can do this kind of on-off switch of whether you have deposit insurance or not, and that obviates the need for regulations. I think the need for what I'll call smart, efficient regulations that permit the banking and credit union sectors to support a growing economy is a larger question than deposit insurance.
Brian, my observations regarding what you raised are a little different from Meg's. My viewpoint was I saw state regulatory authorities and spoke to many and many of them. We petitioned many states to consider ASI over my tenure. And I had the sense, Brian, that, well, Dennis, if we approve you and something would happen, we don't have the backing of the federal government, that puts the burden on the back of the state regulator. And I felt that some of those state regulatory authorities, for their own purposes and reasons, said, we don't want that burden. We feel better with the federal program because we know they'll step in and pick up the pieces. But if we don't pick up the pieces, we're going to be blamed because we approved you, we allowed you to operate, et cetera, et cetera. So that relationship is really critical. And that was one of the problems. And I said, one of the challenges that with 50 states, you run into 50 different types of regulatory authorities, and not just R&D, but the idea of their background, their experience, and their interest level in a non-federal option. It puts a lot of burden on the regulators' back. And I heard that many times.
Thank you. And Dennis, just before maybe you've touched on this, but it's all interesting to me, a credit union in one of the 10 states where you operate has a choice, right? They must have insurance, but they have a choice. They have two. A bank doesn't have a choice, so they would never get to think about this question. How did a credit union think about, would they go with you? Would they go with the NCUA? What was that conversation like in terms of talking to someone who has a choice for a product that is otherwise monopolized?
That's a very good question. The critical points, and there are many, many, many issues, and I've spoke with lots of boards of directors over the years and management teams considering the option. And the bottom line was a lot of state license. Again, we're staying with state license, not Fed license. State licensed credit unions were saying that, hey, we're subject to state regulation, yet our insurer, NCUSIF, comes in and tells us what to do. I have dual regulation. Brian, when you set up, and you were a state regulator, you know well as anybody what the laws say and do. They're not always the same as the federal charter faces. Whether that's bad or good or weak or strong, I'm not going to get into the small issues. But the point was dual regulation was a very big burden to a lot of creditors. Does that mean they were weak and problematic and NCUA was being unfair? Not in all cases. In some cases, they were justified to be concerned about the situation in that institution. The second thing was closeness to the insurer. is 1 in 4,000 versus 1 in 100, you feel like you have a better relationship. And you also feel like that board of directors, which represents the members of the program, the insured institutions of the program, has your interest in mind, not just the government's interest in mind. And NCUA is a federal agency, and they already have a state agency overlooking them. So dual regulation, micromanagement of some of their issues, and the partnership was critical, and the cost was never really an issue. Even though our deposit was a little larger, that was a minor issue. Of course, that's a big, major issue if interest rates are 12%, like back in the 80s, but not when they're in the 2 to 5% range, 3 to 5% range. So the bottom line is, I would say, closeness to the business, the sense of a business partner, the absence of dual regulation they felt was unnecessary, and the ability to have some say in the direction of the program.
Right. We just had a nice, very interesting question come in. What if it's mandatory, but the depositor is responsible for obtaining their insurance? That would seem to perhaps make things a bit more transparent. What about thoughts on that? Meg, do you have any thoughts on that idea that, yes, your deposit has to be insured, and if you wish to be a depositor, insure your deposit?
I'm trying to think mechanically in a world of millions of depositors how you make that work. I think there'd be a consumer and company backlash on that. And I don't know, and it would be interesting to know if there's any country that does it that way of, you know, the 113 that have it. I mean, I just feel, particularly people who are close to the bone or small companies, this is, you know, you can force a borrower to get mortgage insurance as a condition to getting the loan. But I don't think there's a system that forces a creditor, which is what a depositor is, to self-insure for lending their money out. So I'm not very bullish on that idea.
I couldn't agree with you more, Meg. My comment is very simple. Doesn't everybody have a will? No, they don't. You know, so I'm not so sure that the consumer would take care of themselves. That would result in an event that could include a lot of individuals, and that would be havoc from, a government perspective, state or federal.
Maybe as we turn to, you know, you'd alluded to it earlier in your comments, but, you know, what might be, you know, some of the lessons from the 2023 situation? You know, there's, I think, a certain amount of public perception that, oh, what happened is a bunch of very, very wealthy people got bailed out of a problem. You know, whether that's true or not is debatable, of course. But one idea that you had teed up is perhaps, you know, different types of charitable organizations would get enhanced insurance limits. Have you thought about, you know, what would seem to be inevitably a bit of a slippery slope? You know, where would you stop conferring that? Where would you stop conferring that benefit? Have you given some thought to that?
Sure, absolutely. So let's just call it X million, because I don't know what the right amount is. And I think you would set the right amount by looking around at the smaller and regional banks and figuring out if 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 million was the number. And then you would essentially not have it be for human flesh and blood consumers. It would have to be some kind of entity. And it could small business, 501c3, religious entity. You just have to be some kind of legal entity. I'm not super concerned by the slippery slope, because I think that you stop it by having the number. The X million stops it. And I also think I have heard a lot of people say, well, it's really hard to define these accounts. But I've read the Vance bill, I've read the Maxine Waters bill. They do a pretty good job at it. And the additional thing that I would add, because the FDIC, when it comes in, needs record keeping, is if you're going to be one of these, I'm going to call it operational accounts, because I think it's broader than payroll. But if you're going to be one of these, you know, business entity, charitable entity, operational accounts, then when you sign the deposit papers, it has to be specifically tagged as that kind of account. And then in the tech system, in the computer system, up front with the live bank, it has to have the special little marker on it that says this is an operational deposit account, so that if the institution does fail, if the bank does fail, the FDIC already has the record keeping. They don't have to come in and make judgments about whether this was an operational account. And whether there would be, you know, enhanced fees on that, I don't know. I think it could be worked out. But I'm not at all convinced by the slippery slope for a couple of reasons. One is you have the number. The other is, to go back to what you were saying before, the reality is in this country, in bank resolutions, something over what, I can't remember the exact number, 94, 97% of the time, uninsured depositors are protected. They're protected because most bank failures are a straight out purchase and assumption where all of the deposits go to the new and stronger bank. And I would resist calling that a bailout for a number of reasons. One is that I think it's really different from the bailout in the financial crisis. Who won there? Who got bailed out? It was the bondholders. And we've spent 10 years revising the expectations in the bond markets that next time the bondholders will be clipped. And certainly that is what happened in Credit Suisse. So yes, sometimes uninsured are protected, but I'm not sure that that's just a number of rich guys. I think that's the local religious entity. It's the 501c3. It's a small and medium sized corporation. And the reason the systemic risk exception, which again, the banking sector paid for that, was invoked, was because of the social problems of payroll processing.
If I may, add a little bit too, if it's okay. The ESI excess insurance, Brian, that we talked about in the opening comments, they provide up to $5 million above the 250 in most of the states. I can't attest if it's every state. I apologize for that. I've been removed a little bit. And that's very valuable because the individual who makes that deposit, the operating account, the business accounts that Megan, you have talked about, is aware of that fact, of that coverage. Every month that organization submits a listing of all the accounts that are subject to that coverage, and ESI has to provide coverage to that individual. Should day two, the bank, the credit union fail, we might have that obligation of that balance as what it was at the period end. So the excess insurance is helpful, and having it as a marketing tool has helped a lot of credit unions. And lastly, I'll agree with Meg on that most institutions are merged, not liquidated. So when you're merged, the insurance program steps in if there's a cost involved. And don't forget, the insurance program navigating the merger has the ability to work with the value of the assets being transferred. So you have a little bit of a negotiating tool. It isn't necessarily a total loss on the uninsured depository base. So the real key is you have to try your very best to avoid the unexpected crises, not the developing weaknesses. That's what the insurance programs are all about. That's what goes back to what I said earlier about good risk management and business innovative practices to navigate or encourage, promote, push, support, regulate towards a merger that minimizes the cost of the fund, eliminates the public distress that a liquidation causes, and also guarantees those consumers are protected above the 250.
Now, I think we should, there's two questions to think about here. One is, always we have to go back to what kind of banking sector do we need as a country, and particularly in light of the economic changes that we're going to be going through in the next few years. Do we want to be like France or Canada with six large banks that dominate? Do we want to encourage the continued existence and consolidation of a mid-size and regional banking sector so that they become stronger and stronger competitors? Do we want to still have community banks? And I think we want all of that. And I think we don't want to end up like many countries with just five to six super large banks. And I think our economy is better off for it. So if we're going to do that, then we have got to find a way, at least for the next, you know, generational moment, to encourage the small and medium sized enterprise with a $5 million deposit to be at a regional bank, to be at a community bank. Otherwise, depositors, and we see this now, when they perceived that there was danger, they fled. The other thing is that I think we need to, realizing this is the Federalist Society, and I'm somebody who is more on the free market side. And so people say, well, it's a monopoly, it's government, it's too much government, private is better. Normally, I would agree with almost all of that, but there are some exceptions. And deposit insurance as a social good, in my mind, is an exception to the way that we ought to be thinking about it. And we've got a lot of history that shows us that when you don't have deposit insurance, the costs to society and individuals and the economy is too large.
We did just have an interesting question come up. I don't know if anyone's familiar with the study referenced by Professors Hogan and Johnson in 2016 by the Independent Institute that argues that the banking system would be better off without insurance because empirical studies show that it actually increases the risk of financial crisis. Just thought in that, our last minute.
I've never heard of that, but I think that's nuts.
Okay.
I will be very happy to go look at the article and read it, but I would, you know, there were 12 countries that had deposit insurance in 1974. There's 113 now. I suspect that that's going to be a highly theoretical argument. I live in a world of practical reality. But I'm happy to go take a look at it and be convinced otherwise.
And I'd like to make a comment, if I could, Brian, pivoting back to the earlier statement before this one, and that is the smaller institutions such as credit unions do play a vital role in the banking sector, as you've indicated, about how do we keep the number of institutions elevated, or do we end up with four or five major credit unions? Then I think the credit union system does provide an incredible service. It's a member-owned structure, not a stock-owned structure like the California banks were. I have friends that were stockholders in those banks. I know a lot about the banks and their background. And I will tell you that if we want to keep the regional banks, the region's communities served, I think credit unions need to continue to exist. I think options are critical. If it keeps those smaller institutions being swept up and merged by force by a regulatory authority that wants to regulate less institutions, not more. So I support private insurance. I support small institutions.
So if you think about it, we've got about 4,000 and change banks in this country. We've got about 4,000 and change credit unions, so let's call it 8,000. And I don't think there's any reason to focus on the number. It's really about the strength and the community served. Then we've got 8 super large banks, and we've got about 200 largish banks. So let's just say we've got 8,000 depository institutions in this country. France and Canada have between 5 and 6. I think I would submit that there's a number between 5 and 8,000 that probably works. I'm not going to guess where it is, but there is a number there, and I would encourage anybody who has an economics background to do empirical data on what the shape and structure for our economy and our geographic reach works for this country and our culture and our values. And I've looked for it. It's not there. Anybody who has seen that research, send it to me.
Well, the other thing too, Meg, there were 24,000 credit unions 50 years ago. There's about 4,000 issues you've indicated. Contraction has always been 3 to 5% a year. Consolidation, that's not going to change. So I don't disagree with you. Maybe 8,000 is too many, and maybe 4 or 5 is too few. But I know, I'll tell you one thing. I've never seen a year we didn't see contraction. You know, consolidation. So that's part of life. I just hope it isn't sweeping by some sort of form of federal legislation.
In our remaining moments, one final question that I'd like to get in. Let's accept maybe we've proven tonight that there's a social good for deposit insurance. Have we become too enamored of it? And, you know, is it perceived now as kind of a ticket to, you have to have punched before you can get access to other important parts of our infrastructure. So, you know, fintech chartered institutions, those sorts of innovations that people have been talking about tend to not mean so much because to the extent they're uninsured, they don't get access to payment rails and things like that. Have we become over enamored of deposit insurance and think that it's critical for all aspects of our financial infrastructure when it might not be? Meg, I don't know, I'll throw that out to you.
I think that's probably a discussion about master accounts, which is a whole new webinar.
Right, it is.
I think England has managed to give payment charters access to master accounts without deposit insurance. I think the Fed has guidelines out that say that they can do it. They've certainly done it for Numistra recently. The question of, and there are others that they've refused and they're litigating, where that's going to go is fascinating. But as I recall the statute, it only requires that you be eligible for deposit insurance, not that you have it.
Okay. All right. Well, we're coming up pretty close to an hour. Carolyn, I'm trying to check. I think we've addressed all the questions that came into our queue. So thank you, everyone, for the questions, and thank you, panelists, for your thoughtful answers. I guess I'll turn it back to you for concluding comments.
Great. Thank you so much, Brian. And I just want to echo you and say on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our panelists for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.